MENA Watch, der unabhängige Nahost-Think Tank.
Welcome to this episode of MENA Watch Talk. My name is Florian Markel, and it's a special honor for me to welcome Mr. Andrew Tucker as our guest today. Andrew Tucker is a jurist and the director of the Hague Initiative for International Cooperation, THINC abbreviated, an organization founded in 2017. So first of all, Mr. Tucker, welcome and thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Florian. It's good to be here.
Your organization, THINC, describes itself as a global network of international law academics, practitioners and experts in related disciplines. Could you please briefly describe for our audience what is THINC exactly and what do you do?
So we, as I said, it's a network. Really, we were triggered by what we see and we call lawfare within the United Nations. It's really the use and the misuse of the international legal institutions to push certain political or ideological agendas. Of course, using the legal system, there's nothing wrong with that. It happens all the time. Everybody does it. But we feel that is when it comes to the Middle East generally and certainly Israel, there are a lot of political agendas that are being pushed. It's widely recognized in the United Nations. And the legal system, particularly the international courts, but also national courts, the UN Human Rights Council, organizations and institutions like this are lobbied and manipulated to pursue those objectives. And our role is to analyze all of this and to put perhaps different perspective that is sometimes put out into the media and into the UN. We have a focus on Israel, but we look at the Middle East more generally. We do a lot of work also concerning Lebanon, Syria, Iran. We look at the conflict. We look at international humanitarian law, the laws of war, laws of armed conflict, but we look also at international human rights law. We look at other issues relating to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And trying really to unpack the legal issues to help lay people and lawyers to understand the dynamics of the discussion that is taking place. And we do that through our network of academics around the world and others from the legal profession, but also historians, sociologists, and others who participate in this initiative.
You said it's all about combating the misuse of international law. How do we have to understand this? How is international law misused? What are the most common practices or methods of this misuse of international law? And who are the main actors? I mean, you already mentioned the United Nations and international courts. Who are the main actors that you're dealing with?
Well, I think the starting point to understand the United Nations is a political body, and in the General Assembly, every state has an equal vote. So you have 193 member states voting daily, as it were, on issues coming up. And Israel is always at the center of the agenda. And certainly when it comes to the Human Rights Council, where Israel is at the top of the agenda. And it all happens through voting on resolutions. And when you have a majority of states pushing a particular view, and the typical ones are relating to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict when it comes to settlements, occupation, and so forth. This concept that all Israeli settlements are illegal, that the Israeli occupation has become illegal, that Israel is a genocidal state, an apartheid state, that it is a colonialist enterprise that undermines modern concepts of international law. All of these views are ventilated by means of resolutions. So we read resolutions that posit legal positions and even conclusions, and they're widely regarded as being authoritative statements of law, when they're not. They're simply political views dressed up as law, because they've never been adjudicated in an authoritative court. Now, more recently, we're seeing the mobilization or even weaponization of the International Criminal Court, the International Court of Justice, particularly since October the 7th, we've seen this. We'll get into the discussion today. A whole range of cases brought by particularly the Arab Islamic states. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation is a driving group. That's an organization of over 50 UN member states who are members of the OIC. And then when they work together with European states or former Soviet states, they have an automatic majority in the UN, and they can push these resolutions through. And it's their political and ideological view relating to the way the Middle East should be shaped and the position, even elimination of the Jewish state, which in our view is at least we believe that it's a credible perspective to say that this view is driving a lot of the legal rhetoric. So that's what we mean by lawfare. And we could talk about the European Union. You know, the European Union since 1980 has taken the position of the two-state solution. And they regard it politically as a legal requirement that a Palestinian state be established side by side with Israel in the territories occupied in 1967. Now, our analysis is that there's very little legal justification or requirement for that view. Two states may be a desirable political outcome, but it's not a legal requirement. So these are the kinds of issues that we feel are important to be addressing.
I'd like to focus our conversation not so much on the United Nations, but on one of the institutions within the institutional ensemble of the United Nations, which is the International Court of Justice, which, after all, plays a major role in your work, as I understand and I read on your website. Why is this the case? Why is the ICJ, as it's called, so important when it comes to Israel?
So the ICJ is the highest United Nations judicial institution. It's commonly known as the World Court, established, resides here in The Hague in the Peace Palace. And it's just commonly regarded as the most authoritative legal voice in the world. So if you have questions that need to be answered, we go to the ICJ, which has two functions. It can resolve disputes or conflicts between states. It's an interstate judicial tribunal. So states can bring a case if they agree, both parties agree, they can bring it to the court and its decision will be binding on the parties to that conflict. It also has an advisory function. So any UN body, whether it be the General Assembly, whether it be a UN agency, if it has a legal question, it can put that question to the court and the court gives an advice to that UN agency. That's what it's there for. But those advices they're important, they're authoritative, but they're not binding. They're a voice of 15 judges, which are drawn from many different judicial backgrounds and countries. Those 15 judges sit on the bench of the court and they make these advisory opinions. And that advisory opinion function we've seen leveraged over the last years in different contexts to resolve often what are very political questions, whether it be climate change. There's a whole range of things which now non-government organizations mobilize states to bring these cases to the court. Back in 2004, there was a advisory opinion sought in relation to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the status of the security barrier that Israel was constructing in the Second Intifada. The court made an opinion that it felt that that construction was infringing international law in several ways. But since the 7th of October, we've seen several cases now brought to the ICJ to try and have the court make a pronouncement condemning Israel for infringing international law. And they use that advisory opinion process to do it. And then secondly, we now see several states bringing genocide convention cases to the court. These are now contentious cases. We have one now, Myanmar against the Gambia, or the Gambia against Myanmar. And we have South Africa against Israel. States like South Africa and the Gambia are being used by the international organizations like the OIC to bring these cases and, as it were, unlock the court's advisory jurisdiction to get these kinds of legal opinions out into the public arena. Many of them are not binding, but of course, if the ICJ says that Israel is committing genocide, then of course, most people will believe that. So it's an extremely important court, but it is at risk of being politicized and weaponized for political purposes.
As you said, it is a highly respected court, and people always think that, okay, whatever the ICJ says is international law or represents international law. As I understand from your words now, is the ICJ really a neutral institution that does nothing but impartially administer justice, regardless of the issues or the parties involved, or is there also bias within the ICJ and its decisions or its advisory opinions?
Look, it's a very good question. I think the first thing to understand, international law is a unique creature. It's not like our national laws where you can, you know, go into the Austrian or the Dutch civil code and just, you'll know the rules that are applicable to a certain conflict or situation. International law is more complex. It's more political. It's the law of nations. And so it's less able to make very definitive rulings on specific situations. Now, it's more like a kind of set of principles and rules which guide the conduct of nations. But of course, when you're asking the court to make a specific decision on a very concrete situation, we get into the area where the court has to dig deeply into the facts to find out what is going on in the ground, whether it be Myanmar or Nigeria or Israel. And this court is not set up to do that. This is not a criminal court, for example. This is a court of very eminent judges, many of them academics. They don't have a criminal law background, and the court doesn't have the capacity to do fact-finding. So that's an important point. And secondly, all of these judges have their own political perspective. Judges do normally, but it's certainly on the international court. They bring with them their national background, their ideological background. If we take the Chinese judge, for example, I think it's not unfair to say that she would largely represent the political interests of China. Most people would see that. And we have judges from Europe, but we have them from the Middle East, from Africa. And, you know, international lawyers, especially when they're academics, they often have a strong ideology that they bring to the court. And it's very easy for them to look at a situation, particularly a political conflict, through that ideological framework. It's inevitable, I think. So we can call that bias, we can call that influence, but it shapes the way that the court is looking at situations. And I think it's becoming increasingly felt that the court is becoming politicized, and some of the judges are allowing themselves to be led by the interests of certain groups of states.
When we're dealing with Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, oftentimes we're talking about cases that take place or happen during wartime, like after October 7th, for example. Are there any experts on international humanitarian law among these judges, or are they all, respected jurists, but not specialists when it comes to military law or international humanitarian law?
It's an extremely good question, Florian, because indeed many of the judges, most of them do not have a background in international humanitarian law, the laws of war, and many of them don't have a judicial background as well. So they're not used to, ascertaining the rules, the specific rules of lawfare, and international law has a broad set of rules through the Geneva Conventions, for example, and applying those rules to the specifics of the situation. So what we're finding is that they're led very much by the UN reports that are coming out of the UN institutions, whether it be the General Assembly or the Human Rights Council, and they take for granted the factual findings and even the legal findings of those institutions because they don't really have the background or the capacity themselves to go deeply into those questions. And this is a very, very concerning development. You know, let's take the Human Rights Council, which is producing almost on a monthly basis through its Permanent Commission of Inquiry or the Special Rapporteur, Albanese, producing reports condemning Israel continually for breaches of the law of apartheid, breaches of the law of genocide, breaches of international human rights law, international humanitarian law. They're constantly making these findings. And the ICJ, 15 judges, they're dealing with a lot of cases. They don't have the time. So they will take those UN reports as being extremely persuasive, if not almost binding on them. And also because the ICJ is a UN court, it's kind of embedded in that UN system and therefore trusts whatever is coming out of the UN. And this, in our view, is highly problematic.
Let us get to one issue that's been up there with the ICJ in recent years. In 2021, at the request of the UN General Assembly, the ICJ issued an advisory opinion on the subject of Israel and the so-called occupied territories, which many of Israel's so-called critics nowadays like to cite often. Let's set aside the biased framing of the UN General Assembly's questions for a moment and focus on the content of this advisory opinion. What were the key points of this advisory opinion?
So the question, this was a question put by the General Assembly to the court to opine, to give a view on the what was called the legal consequences of Israel's illegal occupation of Palestinian territory. Right. So it was already putting to the court the idea that this is Palestinian territory that Israel is illegally occupying and asking the court to tell us, tell the world what the legal consequences are. That meant by definition, the court was being presented with a biased question. It was being prevented from going deeply into the question of, well, actually, who does the West Bank belong to? Who does the Gaza Strip belong to? And it assumed that arguments were put by the Palestinian Liberation Organization, that which calls itself the State of Palestine, was able to participate in those proceedings, and they put the view that the Palestinians have a kind of absolute right to self-determination, which gives them a right to a state, and that state must encompass the total area of the territories occupied in 67. So the court never did a real historical analysis of the history of this area, the history of the creation of the State of Israel, the Jordanian invasion in 1948, and so forth, and was able to come out with the statement, the conclusion that all the territory, West Bank, even East Jerusalem, belongs to the Palestinians and must become part of the Palestinian state. And as a result, Israel's occupation, according to a majority of judges, has become illegal. Israel must remove Israelis in those territories as soon as possible. Now, that's a highly controversial statement, and a number of the judges in the court were violently in opposition to that. They said this is a very, very poorly reasoned opinion for different reasons. So six of the 15 judges distanced themselves from that opinion. Nevertheless, it's been taken in the international community as a kind of authoritative view that now not only is Israel required to negotiate with the Palestinians, as it seeks to do under the Oslo Accords, but now its occupation has become illegal. It must withdraw unilaterally from the territories. And this is, of course, something Israel refuses to do and believes that it has the right to remain in the territories until a final resolution is negotiated with the Palestinians. That's really the essence of that advisory opinion. It came out in July 2024. And that's really the basis that now we see a number of European states wanting to impose sanctions, boycotts on products from occupied territories, for example, pressuring Israel to remove its civilians and military from the territory.
When Israel came in control of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and the Golan Heights and what was often called East Jerusalem in 1967, no one was calling, I mean, people were calling, the UN was calling it an occupation, but they were not considering illegal that Israel occupied these territories. After all, they were acquired in a preventive war that was provoked very much by the Arab states. So even the Security Council in 1967 didn't say that the occupation, as they call it, is illegal in any way. So what were the reasons for the ICJ to suddenly declare the occupation illegal when it was never before done so by the authoritative institutions for the UN?
Well, the main reason that the court sort of adopted, and this was the legal argument put by the Palestinians and the Arab states, I mean, I was in court during the oral hearings of the case, and the whole set of proceedings was dominated by both the Palestinians and a large number of Arab Islamic states who pushed the view, essentially, the Palestinians have a right to self-determination. This goes right back to 1920 and the mandate for Palestine, they argue, was illegal because it overrode the basic fundamental human rights of the Palestinians being the indigenous people of the land to statehood in their territory. And the court basically sort of assumed this historical narrative is correct. But it's the first time in history that the court, in fact, that anybody has really said that an occupation itself has become illegal. And the reason, as I say, is because it's regarded as a fundamental infringement of the right to self-determination and this right to statehood that the Palestinians apparently seem to have a right to. There's a lot to be said about that as well. You know, there are lots of people groups in the world who would love to have a state. Think of the Kurdish people, for example, but nobody said they have an automatic right to a state. So it's a revision of history, really, and using this rhetoric of human rights to justify this kind of outcome.
Let us now come to the second major issue related to the ICJ, of course, and that's South Africa and South Africa's case against Israel regarding alleged violations of the Genocide Convention. Can you give us an overview of where we currently stand in these proceedings?
Yes, certainly. So the case was started in December 2023, less than 3 months after October the 7th, South Africa, I think it was 29th of December 2023, initiated proceedings at the International Court of Justice, arguing that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza and asking the court to make a ruling, a preliminary ruling, preventing Israel from pursuing the war in the Gaza Strip. It's not the first genocide case before the court. We've seen a number of genocide cases before the ICJ, particularly the ones coming out of the Balkan Wars. We had a series of cases in the first two decades of this century. These are cases brought under the Genocide Convention. The Genocide Convention is a separate treaty. Most states, but not all, but most states are party to that convention. And under the convention, they agree that if there's any dispute between them about the interpretation of the convention or its application, they can bring that case to the court, and the court will have the authority to make a decision. So they're using that that mechanism. Now, what's unusual about this case, but there's another one going on before that. That's the case of the Gambia against Myanmar. This was instituted much earlier, well before October the 7th, and it concerns the conflict in the north of Myanmar and their dealing with the Rohingyas, a very different situation. But that was a case brought by the Gambia, which is not involved in that conflict between Myanmar and the Rohingyas, and neither is South Africa involved in the Gaza Strip. So it's the first time that the convention is being used by states that are not directly have a direct interest in a particular conflict, but they're saying we have a right under the Genocide Convention because every state has an interest in whether or not the convention is being complied with. That's fair enough. That's what the court has said. So that's how South Africa gets into the court. It's a very low threshold that they have to pass to be able to say, well, we have standing to bring this case before the court. The case went through a series of hearings in the first few months of 2024. The courts made a number of preliminary decisions. It has never said, the court has never said that Israel is committing genocide in the Gaza Strip. It did say in February 2024 that there is a plausibility that the South Africans have a right to bring the case, that the Palestinians are a people protected by the convention. That's all the court has said. And now the case is in the what it's called in the merits phase. South Africa has submitted a very substantial set of documents to prove their case. Israel has submitted its reply. This will go through another case. It will take another 3 years before this case is going to get anywhere near a judgment. It's going to be a long time. But in the meantime, a whole range of states have intervened in the court to put their view, and most of them trying to put arguments why Israel should be essentially convicted of committing genocide. This is a very unique way that the convention is now being, I think we can say, used to effectively bring a legal determination of whether or not a state is committing genocide. And as I said, this court is not a court to resolve these kinds of criminal law issues. Genocide is part of international criminal law. So you have to understand the deep facts on the ground in order to make a determination whether or not Israel has the intention, or Myanmar in the case of the Rohingyas, the intention to eliminate or destroy a group as such. That's the essence of the genocide definition, the intention to destroy in whole or in part a group. So mass killings, as bad as they may be, are not proof of genocide. You have to prove the intention. And this is the core issue at the moment in these cases.
You said that there were a number of genocide cases brought before the court in the past, among them the International Special Tribunals for Rwanda and of course, all the proceedings dealing with the Yugoslavian wars. But convictions for genocide have so far been rather rare, not least because it's not a common crime, and the courts have so far required very strict standards of proof to establish the all-important intent to commit genocide that you were talking about just a second ago. So based on the case law, it would be actually out of the question for Israel to be convicted, wouldn't it?
Well, you would think so, you know. But you're absolutely right to say that the standard has been set extremely high by the courts. It's a criminal law standard. You have to prove beyond reasonable doubt that an individual or members of the government or people responsible, because it's a criminal law issue, it's about what individuals do. So the court has said, well, the standard of proof is very high, and as a result, it's been very difficult to prove. Now, what's happening now is that a number of states are saying, well, you know what? We need to broaden the scope of this convention. There's a lot of horrific things going on around the world. We don't have a tribunal capable of resolving them. We need to bring more cases within the concept of genocide than we have in the past. And in order to do that, we need to lower the standard of proof, and we need to broaden the range of evidence that can be brought to prove the intention. It's still about intention, but because now it's about, and this is the unique thing about the Myanmar and Israel cases, it's no longer just about particular individuals. It's about whether the state has complied with its obligations to prevent and punish genocide. And normally, as you said, in the Rwanda tribunal or other tribunals have gone deeply into the facts to work out whether or not this criminal standard of proof has been met. Now they're avoiding these external tribunals, going straight to a court that is not a criminal law court, doesn't have rules of evidence like independent criminal law tribunals. It can't do cross-examination. It can't go and do fact-finding on the ground. It's dependent on what UN commissions tell it are the facts on the ground. And this is opening up a very different kind of scenario whereby a number of states, and this is where it gets very interesting, we have the Netherlands, Germany, Denmark, United Kingdom, and Canada, who are arguing in the Myanmar case, and by extension, this will also apply in the Israel case. They say, well, look, we may not be able to prove that the relevant people had a subjective intention to destroy the Rohingyas or the Palestinians, but we can infer it by the fact, for example, that a lot of children are being killed or a lot of people are being displaced. And they're urging the court to say, well, look at these inferential circumstances and draw a conclusion from them that the intention must have been to commit genocide. So you can see how it sort of broadens this whole way of looking at a conflict. And when the court doesn't know the facts on the ground, except what's presented to it by UN agencies, it doesn't have the capacity to look at all the counterfactual circumstances, right? So if the court goes down this route, and we don't know whether the court will because the Myanmar decision hasn't been made yet, it will come out in October, but if it goes down this route of broadening the definition, lowering the sort of standard of evidence, then that will be the test that will be applied in the South Africa-Israel case. And then it becomes much more possible that Israel will, in fact, be held to have failed in its obligations to prevent genocide. So we have a whole new situation here.
So we could say that this Myanmar case somehow lays the groundwork for a conviction of Israel later on, or it could be laid via this Myanmar case. But with the active assistance of states like, as you said, Germany and other Western nations, is that what's taking place, and why are they doing it?
Yeah, it's a super question, and we don't know the answer, except that We understand that a lot of this has been driven actually by the Netherlands. We have a very, let's say, activist legal department within our Ministry of Foreign Affairs in the Netherlands. They reached out to a number of other states, including Germany and Canada and the UK, to join them in putting this view to the court. And it's a view that's represented broadly in the academic world. Those who have, let's say, a more progressive activist perspective is that in order to, and it's in a sense understandable, you know, in order to bring to account the perpetrators of these gross crimes and abuses of international law, we need to give the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, a broader jurisdiction. This has partly got to do with the failure of the International Criminal Court to do its job of really convicting criminals of war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, and so forth. So the courts, people are looking now more to the ICJ as being the mechanism to bring to justice these gross violations. But the danger of doing that is you're empowering a court really to do something it's not equipped to do. As I said, it's not a criminal court. It doesn't have the rules and the procedures really that it needs. So it becomes a very political kind of process. So I think the European states that I mentioned put this view to the court, and they did this before the South Africa case really was up and running. They put it, I think many of them had the Israel case in mind. They were seeking the court to make a ruling that would lay the foundations for the Israel hearing, Israel case, to be more likely to convict Israel. On the other side, we know the Islamic states very much have that agenda. You know, why is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation effectively funding the Gambia to bring a case against Myanmar? Why is it effectively funding South Africa and Iran, Qatar, many of these states, to bring the case against Israel? Well, we know they have a political agenda when it comes to Israel. So it's very transparent. So I think it's a fair and reasonable inference to say many of these states are really using the Myanmar proceedings. I think when it comes to Canada, for example, or Germany, I don't think they realized necessarily the implications of this approach. They call it the holistic approach to genocide. And, of course, Germany has a big interest in this because Germany's facing its own allegations brought by Nicaragua that it is responsible for enabling Israel to commit genocide. So if the court's going to broaden the definition, it's going to be more likely that Germany itself will be held to have infringed its obligations under the Genocide Convention. So it goes completely against the interests of Germany, and yet they're the ones who are participating in putting this case. It's quite strange, actually.
Who is it who is actually doing the case? For example, let's say with Germany, who are the ones who work on the Myanmar case, for example? Somewhere within the foreign ministry, or who is responsible for that? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, Germany has never, the official German position is, so far at least, has been they don't come to the conclusion that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. No.
And that's correct.
If they're working or laying the groundwork in order to get a conviction of Israel because of genocide, so is the one hand not knowing what the other hand is doing, or who is doing the work actually?
So officially, the decision is normally made by the Minister of Foreign Affairs whether or not to participate in certain legal proceedings. So in the Myanmar case, it would have been a decision made by the Minister of Foreign Affairs at the time. We're going back now to 2024 to make an intervention in those proceedings, and they would have done that on the advice of their legal department. So the lawyers are asked to advise, you know, should we do this? What is the case? What is in Germany's interests? And what does international law tell us about the law of genocide? And it seems, and I'm not saying that the German lawyers had an intention to use this to influence the Israel case. I don't know. But it's highly possible that they were influenced by it. But either way, they seem to have persuaded the foreign minister to allow them to intervene in the ICJ case. You'll find that most of the documents are signed by the main legal advisors within the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. I don't know off the top of my head if in Germany's case that was the legal advisor. It certainly was. The Dutch document was signed by the lead lawyer on the case, the same in Canada. So I assume it's the same in Germany. And I think, to be honest, when this happens, the political leaders often don't understand the implications of what they're doing. And I suspect that in late 2024, when Germany put this position to the court in the Myanmar case, they may not have realized what the implications would be for Germany in the Israel case and the case of Nicaragua against Germany. But clearly, there is an influence. It is going to be highly influential. And it would be very interesting to know what the position is of the German government at the moment. By the way, the Nicaragua case is on the agenda of the court in the next couple of weeks. There'll be hearings. Germany is arguing that Nicaragua doesn't have a case. Germany shouldn't be in court. You know, this whole thing should be thrown out, but we'll see if the court accepts that argument.
Going back to the Myanmar case, you said the ruling is expected to be given in October. What's your guess? Will the court go down that road in direction of a, as you said, a more holistic interpretation of the Genocide Convention, or what do you think?
Look, personally, I think that we will find a majority of judges who will support the conclusion that Myanmar is committing genocide. We don't know because we don't know exactly, but we know that the decision is being prepared at the moment. I think if you look at the judges on the court, you look at the questions that they asked during the legal proceedings, if you look at their background, the things they've said in the past about genocide and so forth, I'm pretty sure it'll be, I think it's a strong chance that a majority of the 15 judges, so at least 8, will come down. And I think, you know, many of these are academics, so that they tend to have a very progressive, almost an activist view of the law and a view of the court's jurisdiction. They're looking to broaden it. So I think looking at those judges, it's quite possible we'll see a judgment that lays the foundation for in a very academic way of broadening this concept of genocide. And if so, obviously that's going to influence future cases.
But would it be necessary in the Myanmar case to broaden the approach?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think so necessarily. I'm not an expert on the Myanmar case, but it would seem to me quite possible. There was a UN fact-finding mission on this case at the time of the conflict. They reached the conclusion there are reasonable grounds to conclude that Myanmar or certain elements within the Myanmar leadership and army had an intentional genocide intent. It's quite possible that fact-finding commission did a more rigorous examination of the facts than is the case in the Israel situation, where the UN bodies haven't had access to the facts on the ground in the same way. So I think it would be possible, even on the existing jurisprudence concerning genocide, to find Myanmar guilty. So again, I think it will be driven perhaps not so much by whether that conflict can be, that decision can be resolved, but by looking more generally at, well, what do we want with this genocide convention? Where are we heading? And this idea that the court should be looking more and more at factual things that start to look like genocide, because it's our only forum for determining on the issue, or it's becoming our only forum.
Well, definitely a very fascinating and interesting point, and we'll definitely keep following up on this. I'd like to take the opportunity to thank you, Mr. Tucker. I think our viewers had the opportunity to learn quite a bit from our conversation today. So thank you very much once again for taking the time to be our guest.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much, and happy to talk to you about these very, very interesting developments.
And finally, to you, dear viewers, as always at this point, here's our request. If you enjoyed this video, please give it a thumbs up, leave a comment in the comment section below, or subscribe to our channel if you haven't already done so. Thank you very much for your attention, and see you in the next video.
MENAWATCH, der unabhängige Nahost-Think-Tank. Besuchen Sie auch unsere Website. Dort finden Sie täglich neue aktuelle Berichte und ausführliche wissenschaftlich fundierte Hintergrundanalysen zur Geschichte und Gegenwart der MENA-Region.
Eine Produktion von MENAWATCH, dem unabhängigen Nahost-Think-Tank. Auf unserer Website finden Sie täglich aktuelle Informationen und Analysen. Besuchen Sie uns.